Translation by His Divine Grace Srila Prabhupada. Who else but the gross materialists will neglect such transcendental thought and take to the non-permanent names only, seeing the mass of people fallen in the river of suffering as the consequence of accruing the result of their own work? Purport. In the Vedas, it is said that persons who are attached to demigods, to the exclusion of the Supreme Personality of Godhead, are like animals who follow the herdsman, even though they are taken to the slaughterhouse. The materialists, like animals, also do not know how they are being misdirected by neglecting the transcendental thought of the Supreme Person. No one can remain vacant of thought. It is said that an idle brain is a devil's workshop, because a person who cannot think in the right way must think of something which may bring about disaster. The materialists are always worshipping some minor demigods, although this is condemned in the Bhagavad Gita 7.20. As long as a person is illusioned by material gains, he petitions the respective demigods to draw some particular benefit, which is, after all, illusory and non-permanent. The enlightened transcendentalist is not captivated by such illusory things. Therefore, he is always absorbed in the transcendental thought of the Supreme in different stages of realization, namely Brahman, Paramatma, and Bhagavan. In the previous verse, it is suggested that one should think of the Supersoul, which is one step higher than the impersonal thought of Brahman, as it was suggested in the case of contemplating the Virat Rupa of the Personality of Godhead. Intelligent persons who can see properly may look into the general conditions of the living entities who are wandering in the cycle of the 8,400,000 species of life, as well as in different classes of human beings. It is said that there is an everlasting belt of water called the River Vaitarani at the entrance of the plutonic planet of Yamaraj, who punishes sinners in different manners. After being subjected to such sufferings, a sinner is awarded a particular species of life according to his deeds in the past. Such living entities are punished, as are punished by Yamaraj, are seen in different varieties of conditioned life. Some of them are in heaven, and some of them are in hell. Some of them are brahmanas, and some of them are misers. But no one is happy in this material world, and all of them are either class A, B, or C prisoners, suffering because of their own deeds. The Lord is impartial to all circumstances of the sufferings of the living entities. But to one who takes shelter at his lotus feet, the Lord gives proper protection, and he takes such a living entity back home, back to himself. Srila Prabhupada ki. So a very interesting verse here. Quite technical, quite a deep verse. And one where Prabhupada emphasizes thought a number of times in the purport. The importance of thought. There is transcendental thought. Then there is illusory thought. There's thought of Brahman, thought of Paramatma, thought of Bhagavan. And it seems to tie into the idea that we are the International Society for Krishna Consciousness. Because consciousness is all about thought, isn't it? Consciousness ultimately is the symptom of the soul. That is the way by which we can detect life, or detect the presence of the soul in not just humans, but in any species. Consciousness is a symptom of the soul. And the way that consciousness manifests for us as humans is when we are able to express it and able to work with it using these layers of the mind and intelligence and ego. Now, strictly speaking, these layers actually are an impediment rather than a facilitating medium. The mind, intelligence, and ego are the covering, the subtle covering that accompanies the soul between its various destinations. But as well as facilitating that soul's interaction through this body, it acts as a sort of glue which allows us to interact with this physical body. It is also an impediment in one sense, because the soul is not supposed to be covered and restricted by the limits of a material mind. Nevertheless, consciousness is expressed, and a great deal of our efforts in Krishna consciousness are about, first of all, controlling the mind so that it becomes a friend of our conscious endeavors to go back to Krishna. And then secondly, to make it as transparent as possible so that the real Krishna consciousness of the soul can be expressed fully. So in the conditioned state, we do have to do some work on the mind, and that work centers around conditioning or removing the conditioning from our mind which prevents the real glory of the soul shining through. So that's the task we have in human life. It is said Krishna consciousness is already there within each living entity. It's already there, dormant. It just needs to be encouraged, awoken. And an important part of that process is reducing the influence of the coverings. So now typically the gross body, which is composed of many senses, organs, organs of action, organs of perception, it feeds so many impulses into the mind. The mind, the intelligence, they combine together to try to increase the contact of the senses with sense objects. That's basically that's the program in most people's minds. Practically everyone in this world, conditioned living entity, has this program. It's just constantly running. How to bring my senses into contact with more sense objects. How to extract more enjoyment from that process. If this sense object doesn't work, let's try another. Let's try a different flavor. Let's try a different scenario, a different scene. Each one of our senses, the sight, sound, touch, has suitable objects which will interact with it. And so most people's lives are simply centered around that. And that's on a very gross level. Then those who are a little more refined than that operate perhaps on the platform of the mind. They like their mind to be in perhaps a calm, peaceful state, in a more elevated state perhaps, something which we could consider to be perhaps more mode of goodness. Some people live in the mental world. You know, they like to contemplate things. They're philosophers, maybe they're musicians, maybe they're whatever. They have a slightly more refined view of the world. And then there are those, obviously, with the intelligence, those who like to philosophize more, those who like to explore, research. These are all different ways by which one tries to enjoy themselves in this world, using subtle means or gross means. With the gross, it's easy to see. We have gross organs and they interact with gross things. You have a nice tasty item, your tongue is involved, your mouth is involved, all the senses are involved. With the mind, it's a little more difficult. People are driven by concepts. Concepts, they contemplate, they meditate, and then they explore different ways. Friendships, relationships are all ways by which the subtle aspect is also nourished. All of these stills are unfortunately centered around trying to extract enjoyment from this world. And only when one fully transcends these, gives up the subtle and gross bodies, does one act on the platform of the soul in natural connection with Krishna. And that is pure Krishna consciousness. And it's pure Krishna consciousness. So who else but the gross materialists will neglect such transcendental thought? So you have to be a really gross materialist to neglect transcendental thought. And what is that transcendental thought? Well, that was described in the previous few verses. Transcendental thought of rendering service to the supersoul. Understanding that he is the ultimate goal of life. And by worshipping him, one can end the cause of conditioned state of existence. So that's transcendental thought that most people aren't interested in. Most people in this world have no interest in those things. They don't accept that their sufferings in this world have a reason, have a basis. But it says clearly here in this verse that the mass of people are fallen in the river of suffering, which is as the consequence of accruing the result of their own work. Their own work has caused them to fall into this river of suffering. So that's very important, because it does say that one who patiently tolerates the reactions of his past misdeeds, right? There's a verse, one who patiently tolerates the reactions of his past misdeeds, awaiting the mercy of the Lord, eventually attains the kingdom of God. You have to acknowledge, though, that what we are receiving is the consequence of our past misdeeds. So people don't like that idea. They don't like ownership. People do not like to take ownership for any problems. They always just want to blame someone else. Blame this person, that person, blame the weather, blame the environment, blame the government, blame this party, blame religion, blame God. It's common. God gets a lot of flack these days. Almost everyone blames him and then disregards him. At least if you're going to blame him, at least try and form a relationship with him. At least try to understand who you're blaming. So that would be refreshing. That would be a start. At least that would be the start of a person's Krishna consciousness. Because there are multiple ways to connect with the Lord. But actually we're in an environment where the prevalence is atheism. Where the idea of God, the idea of wholesome life based upon the soul is basically being actively removed from people's consciousness. Through gadgets, through science, through technology, we are being taught that God is simply a concept that is optional. Opium for the masses, as someone said. You know? Who was it? Marx? Marx, opium for the masses, whereby you keep the masses under control. You keep them stoned, effectively. So that then they're happy and submissive and the governments can do what they like with them. So they see it as a tool. But they miss the whole point. That actually, I mean, at least they acknowledge the fact that religion does lead to better behaved people. That is an important side effect. We see as religion around the world has decreased and largely disappeared, you see the behavior of people has also degraded. There are only a very few remnants now of good behavior, morals, kindness in operation. Each of these are subject to concoctions. Each generation concocts. Laws are produced which concoct. And there is no central, eternal frame of reference anymore for these things. We're supposed to be kind, not because there's an injunction to do so, but because it's a natural expression of the soul. If we understand that the Supreme Lord is the Father of all the living entities, Aham Bija Pradapita, I am the seed-giving Father of all living entities, and He cares equally about all living entities, then it should be obvious to someone with a little intelligence that if you do something to displease another living entity, which is ultimately God's, ultimately His, and also gives Him pleasure, then that's probably not a wise course of action. You don't go about displeasing someone if the Supreme Lord who you are trying to please takes pleasure in that person's association. The devotees don't think like that. They think in other ways. In Queen Kunti's prayers, she starts to glorify at one point all the other devotees that are dear to Krishna. Because she knows that will give Krishna great pleasure. So she speaks about the Pandavas, the Vrishnis. She speaks about the gopis. She speaks about persons who are dear and close to Krishna. And she considers herself to be not particularly dear to Krishna. Which, of course, is the other method, the other mood of expression of a devotee. So, in this way, the devotees are naturally kind. But these days, it has to be taught as a lesson. Why? Because the fundamentals have been completely removed. Now, people need to be educated why it's bad to engage in crime, why it's bad to steal. You need a whole philosophical lesson on it. You need probably many lessons through different subjects, how to be a good citizen in society, etc. All based around sense gratification. If I engage in criminal activity, it will reduce someone else's sense gratification. Or if I engage in criminal activity, there will be some punishment for me which will reduce my sense gratification. That's literally the only framework, the only basis by which people consider things now. Will it affect me? Will it reduce my wealth? Will it reduce my power? Will it reduce my control and my enjoyment? If any of these are compromised, they might consider doing something. It's a somewhat of a disappointing state of affairs. the state of affairs where one considers that the Supreme Lord is our Father, the well-wisher of all living entities, and we are here under His superintendence and under His care and affection, and shouldn't we try to do something to please Him? That notion is missing, sadly. And it is only through understanding the position of the Lord and the philosophy of Krishna consciousness is there a chance that that will be re-established. In our tradition, it is very clearly stated that sense gratification is a serious problem. But practically in no other paths is this point brought out so strongly. There have been great saints and renunciates in all paths, actually, who actually understand the principle. But in terms of practical teaching, practical instruction, this point is not emphasized much. Rather, we are emphasized to acknowledge the supremacy of God, to do a few things, a few rituals of our particular denomination of faith, and then to enjoy. Then to enjoy the rest of the time. So that's something which in ISKCON, in Krishna consciousness, in Vedic line of thinking, is something we have to understand carefully. That enjoyment is a propensity for enjoyment is a manifestation of lust. And that's described as a disease, kamam ridrogam. It is a disease which sits, it's a disease of the heart, ridrogam. You know, no one wants a disease, but it's infected our heart. Lust means the desire to constantly enjoy the product of material nature. A hankering for uniting the senses with sense objects. That's ultimately what it means in a deeper sense. And so because, as I mentioned, that already drives the activities of the living entities, it means they are in trouble. And the river of suffering is the consequence. When people undertake certain activities in their life, there are consequences. There will be good consequences, there will be bad consequences. And some of those are unpalatable. They do involve suffering. Just as we cause suffering to others, as we cause suffering to other living entities, Mother Nature, so similarly that suffering is going to come to us. All the millions of animals sent to slaughterhouses in a highly mechanized, normalized manner, people think there's no consequence. Well, most sensible people think this is wrong. But because that sensibility has been erased and there is extensive dogma to ensure it remains erased in the minds of most people, the situation, the industry expands and continues. Such immense harm being caused to other living entities, other innocent creatures. So really one has to be a gross materialist to neglect these items of transcendental thought which relate to Krishna. All morals, all guidelines, welfare of the environment, welfare of us, our health, all of these things can be addressed through Krishna consciousness at the center. So when different individuals pick out different items of these, without the central unifying theme of Krishna, their efforts are somewhat misguided to varying degrees, and also you know for sure they will be temporary. As soon as one particular agenda has been met, it'll be let's concoct another agenda which gives us now a new motivation to do something. So that is the problem. People are not so much interested in causes because they don't have any underlying substance. Just the latest whims of the society, contemporary thought. That's the currently fashionable thought. The same people would have been advocating something completely different 30 years ago. But now they're talking as if they are the unquestioned authorities on the subject. So this is the standard hypocrisy of the world. Without Krishna, this will continue and will continue forever. Each person needs Krishna in their life because Krishna is in their life because He's the reality. He's the reality. He exists. The Lord exists. And the acharyas undergo great attempts to help us understand this. He can be understood, as the Vedas explain, through different ways. Through sense perception, one can one can start to contemplate the possibility that the Lord exists. Through sense perception, as described in the Gita, one can understand the Lord's existence. I'm the fragrance of the earth, taste of the water. You know, all of these things. All these are ways by which we can use our mundane, blunt senses to actually understand the presence of the Lord. Then in subtle ways, one can do that. Through meditation, through philosophy. One who studies this sacred conversation of mine, Krishna says in the Gita, worships me with his intelligence. One can contemplate, one can think. One can endeavor to understand that there is a supreme person. Now the details of that supreme person have to be actually understood through parampara, because no level of sense exploration or mental concoction or philosophical work will actually lead us directly to understanding the Supreme Lord, because he is inconceivable. He is way beyond our faculties. He's way beyond the limits of our faculties. So we cannot just use our faculties and think we will understand the Lord. Rather, we have to take advice from Shastra and the Acharyas. And so the Acharyas play a great role in this. It's said here that persons, materialists are always worshipping some minor demigods. And so I was thinking, I mean, most people aren't worshipping demigods as such. They don't even acknowledge their existence. But in another way they are, because they have deified, turned into deities, others, other objects, other persons. Those people who they look up to in the movie spheres, in the sing-song arena, in sports, these are the deities. These are their deities. Google is God, we hear sometimes. Google is the deity for some people, the source of all knowledge, the source of all wisdom. Impartial. Is it really impartial? If anyone's ever done a search, how much impartiality is there? Once you've got through all the business links at the top, you receive simply a mass of speculations from around the world on any particular topic. Yet people think this is a great authority, a source of collected wisdom, so-called. Of course there is some wisdom thrown in there, amidst, of course, but sorting out the wisdom from the mess, who can do all that? Yet these are the deities for people. Technology, the process of science, is a deity. It's something to worship, something to treasure. It's okay if you remove all other aspects to do with God, wholesome life, but you must make prominent science, technology, etc. Now, science and technology, as we've said many times, it's not a problem really as such. It's not in itself a problem. It's a tool that can be used in multiple ways. But one thing is undeniable, is that when people develop excessive faith in science and technology, their behavior deteriorates. They become increasingly sinful. Science and technology facilitates a mass engagement in sense gratification, which for advanced persons is not the goal of life. So therein lies the danger. So again, we have to separate the tool from the user, the tool from the motivation. As we say many times, a knife in the hands of a surgeon is a good thing. A knife in the hands of a criminal is not such a good thing. So it's not the knife that's at fault in that sense. But the presence of knives clearly means that those individuals who are less in control of themselves are going to cause crime. It's simple, isn't it? If there are ferocious weapons available, and this is a constant discussion in America, especially with gun crime, if there weren't so many guns, crime would be reduced. I mean, it's a sensible concept to most people. But there is always many factors to consider. So people... Shri Shri Radha Gokulananda Ki. So we have to understand that when there are dangerous factors, products of technology, which delude people and bewilder them and cause them to think that something material and impermanent is actually something saintly, then you can see how the general culture of the world decreases. And so the Acharyas especially put in great effort into redressing this situation. And so today is the disappearance of Sri Madhvacharya. So I thought I'd say a few words about Madhvacharya, who appeared around 12th, 13th century. And specifically his contribution, he's a very, very incredible person in the Brahma line. And his specific contribution was to establish the Dvaita philosophy, the philosophy of dualism, the philosophy of difference between the living entity and the Lord. So faced with a backdrop of Advaita, of oneness, which is coming from the Shankarites and then Buddhist philosophy also to some extent, prevalent at that time. So with Madhvacharya, the movement, or the, you can say the fabric of Vaishnav thought received a great boost in terms of a very clear distinction between the Lord and the living entities. The Lord and the living entities are always different. And one is the servant, and one is the master. Now, our line itself is called the Brahma Madhva Gaudiya Sampradaya. It is directly in that line of Madhvacharya. And of course, we do honor and accept, of course, the four bona fide sampradayas. For example, Ramanujacharya is the head of one of the other sampradayas as well. And his Vishishta Advaita. Each of our acharyas has contributed a special, you can say, not brand, but special flavor of reality. Has emphasized, you can say, a special flavor of reality, which over time has helped us to understand the Supreme Lord. So in Lord Chaitanya, as we know, he took different elements from different sampradayas. Commonly we say he took two principles from each of the sampradayas and combined them into what we have now as the Gaudiya Vaishnav line. And so Madhvacharya is a very key and prominent person in this. He's described as being Bhima, Hanuman also in previous appearances. And appearing in the region of Udupi, he performed many great pastimes. It was clear that he was an exalted person right from a young age. He took initiation at age 5. Now, in their tradition, the young boys would take initiation around 8 from the Brahmin community, and they would be trained up to be pujaris, etc., from that age. But he was so exceptional, he took at age 5, and then sannyas at age 13. It was clear that this is a truly exceptional person. He did many, many different feats of amazing, displayed many feats of amazing power. His mother, whenever she was in anxiety, when she would call him, she said he would appear there in one leap. He would simply take one leap from wherever he was and he would immediately appear there before her. These are just some of the small things. You can obviously read in much more detail about Madhvacharya. But Madhvacharya made a number of contributions to our line. So I thought I'd just read some of the main principles that we take from him. So some of his teachings, which are particularly prominent for us, are that Krishna is known as Hari and he's the Supreme Lord, the Absolute. So obviously different persons, different traditions have emphasized different deities in the past. And ironically, actually, if you look at the Ramanuja lines and the Madhva lines, the majority of worship that takes place within those communities now is actually worship of Lord Ramachandra. But this is Madhvacharya's emphasis, that Krishna, who is known as the Supreme Lord, is the Absolute. And he may be known through the Vedas. This is a key principle for us as well. Vedeshya sarveraham eva vedyo. But he can be known through the Vedas. So you can see our acharyas have taken on this task of establishing the importance of the Vedas. Whereas Shankara rejected, Buddhists didn't follow at all. Madhvacharya has to redevelop this understanding. The material world is real. real, it exists. It might not seem so outstanding to us, but it is a concept that philosophically is very important. The jivas or the souls are different from the Supreme Lord. This is the Dvaita aspect, the difference. The jiva is not the Supreme Lord and is different. The jivas are by nature servants of the Supreme Lord. That is their relationship with him. They're not persons on an equal footing. They don't participate in activities equally. They are servants. There are two categories of jivas, the liberated and the illusioned. And liberation means attaining the lotus feet of Krishna. That is entering into an eternal relationship of service to him. You can see how these are principles which are directly preached and used and accepted by us. Pure devotional service is the cause of this relationship. This relationship can be established through pure devotional service. And the truth may be known through direct perception, inference, and Vedic authority. So these are the ways that I was referring to earlier. Direct perception through the senses, inference using the mind and intelligence, and Vedic authority, ultimately Shabda Brahman, which is the most accurate and the highest form of realizing and understanding concepts. So Madhvacharya made a number of important contributions, as you can see philosophically. He engaged in extensive worship. He traveled to Badrinath a number of times. He was directly instructed by Srila Vyasadeva when he went there. So in one sense, we are getting teachings through Madhvacharya and in our line, right from Lord Brahma, Narad Muni, Srila Vyasadeva, right down to all the persons that we read about in the Bhagavatams were described in Canto 1, and now Canto 2 deals with Lord Brahma. All of these are directly in the line of Madhva. And so Madhvacharya is a great and important personality. There's so much more that can be said, but I suggest we can do more research later if we want to discuss his glories. But if we try and understand that this concept that he emphasized, this Dvaita philosophy, is key to us. And as I was mentioning, Lord Ramachandra is typically worshipped in the Madhva Ramanuja lines, culturally speaking. And so today we should also say something about Lord Ramachandra. It's Vijayadashami, the day in which Lord Ramachandra finally steals victory over this rascal Ravana, who caused so much difficulty. Ravana is perhaps a direct embodiment of this concept I mentioned earlier, kamam ridrogam, a person who had lust at the core of his heart. He was completely diseased with this. He had absolutely everything. He'd stolen all the wealth from Kuvera, he had nothing left. But he decided to take something that was never going to be his. He tried to take Srimati Sita Devi, who is the Lord's. She belongs to the Lord, not available as an item of material enjoyment. But this is what happens when one becomes so infatuated with the senses, the mind, that they completely lose the plot and they do not know where to stop. So this eventually happens. Even though you have absolutely everything, you go one step further and you try to take what belongs to the Lord. So in a subtle sense, most people are trying to do that in this world. They want the opulence of the Lord. They want to remove the Lord. And so when a person like Ravana comes across Lord Ram or his associates, he thinks, let me remove all the associates. Let me remove the Lord and let me take his property. Of course, they're all fools because they can never succeed in that enterprise. It doesn't matter how much they convince themselves through their atheistic philosophy that they are supreme. They will never succeed. Hiranyakashipu, Hiranyaksha, they all discovered the same thing. Kamsa discovered exactly the same thing. Ravana, with his heart full of lust, and we know he's depicted with 10 heads, each displaying one of the deep problems, anger, pride, etc. He had multiple chances to rectify his ways. He had multiple opportunities. Lord Ram even declared, after giving shelter to Vibhishan, He declared, if anyone takes shelter of me, I will protect them, be they my enemy or whatever. He had multiple opportunities to surrender to the Lord, to beg forgiveness, to return Mother Sita even. But he didn't do that. He didn't take any of those opportunities. And therefore finally, when there was no other options left, the Lord finished him off. He played with him for some time, fought with him, and then finally fired his transcendental arrows right into the core of Ravana's heart. There it said Ravana had some nectar, which was giving him life-sustaining force. And with that he dried all of that up and killed Ravana. And everyone celebrated. Sri Ramachandra Bhagavan ki. And so Dashera is a great festive occasion. We're fortunate that we're one of the few places where Prabhupada wanted the installation of Lord Ram. Juhu, obviously. And the manner, it was his desire that Lord Ramachandra should be welcomed here. And when we're here in the presence of Lord Ram, Sita Devi, Lakshmanji and Sri Hanuman, it is always wonderful to discuss their pastimes as well. The Lord, his identity, his personality cannot be separated from his name, fame, qualities, activities, pastimes. So it is very important to also celebrate his pastimes. Through remembering the Lord, through contemplating his Leela, we get very close to the Lord. We have a chance to worship the Lord. And so specifically, Lord Ram is a very perfect person. He's an ideal king, an ideal person, the ideal husband, the ideal protector. And he comes and has such wonderful Leelas with his entourage, with Lakshman, who is the embodiment of austerity during all that time in the forest. Hanuman, who is his unquestioned servant, who is also Madhvacharya, who appears as Madhvacharya. So Lord Ram's Leela is intimately connected with our Krishna conscious progress. And so obviously we'll be celebrating the Dashera more on Sunday with a festival. But it is nice that on this day itself that we think that today was the culmination of the Lord's great adventure, massive epic adventure, which is perhaps one of the original epics of the world, full of demons, rakshasas, snakes, power, weapons, technology, everything, magic spells. It's the origin of all epics and powers. And this happened. And the culmination of it is that Ravana's lust, which he failed to give up on multiple occasions, was finally vanquished by the Lord. And so this is both a warning and a source of inspiration for us. If we don't voluntarily take steps to give up this disease of the heart, to find the right antibiotics for it, then eventually it will consume us. In that diseased state, there is no limit to the degradation that we will bring upon ourselves and others. And we can imagine that as Kali Yuga increases, we know where this is going. The longer we are hanging around in Kali Yuga, the worse the situation that we're going to be experiencing. And we will also have developed the qualities that allow us to be in that situation, which means we will be degrading. So we don't want to be there for too long. So let's try our best to take advice from the Gita, from the Bhagavatam, from the pastimes of the Lord, and try to cure this Ridrogam, and then attain success and freedom ultimately from suffering. I mean, who doesn't want that? Who doesn't want to be free from suffering? It's not something that you have to be persuaded of, really, is it? No one likes to suffer. We all want to be free. And so this is our process. This is the process of Krishna consciousness. So I'll stop there. Any questions? Any comments? Yes, Srinivas Prabhu.
So Madhvacharya's contribution was two things. Defeat of Mayavad philosophy and establishment of deity worship.
Mm-hmm. Yes, thank you. Those were the two principles. Mayavad is a rampant disease which really stops the living entity getting anywhere close to God. Turn up, Prabhu.
Thank you, Prabhu. I'm just wondering, it would be very interesting to connect like activities and mood of Madhvacharya with Hanuman? Like, is any, was he acting like in mood of Hanuman, or like, you know, or some, even philosophy? I mean, I don't know, is it any much about Hanuman's philosophy? He was pure servant.
Well, he demonstrated a Hanuman strength on multiple occasions. I can't remember all the different pastimes, but does anyone know some of Madhvacharya's
feats? Is that when he put a finger down on the is that him? Or this was maybe somebody else. And then was some bigger wrestler. They were challenging him or something. Biggest wrestler in India at that time. And he said, okay, if you can move my toe, I'll surrender. I think it's Madhvacharya.
Could be. I can't remember the pastime so clearly. But do you know? This one?
There was another pastime also.
His father was in debt.
Yes,
he got hammered and turned into gold coins and paid off the debt.
That's right. He did many mystic things like that. Lord Ram would have been known to be an object of worship, but specifically in that line they were worshipping Krishna.
Actually, there was another pastime where a pot was...
Yes, the Chandan.
You know, you can mention it.
Yeah, there was this merchant ship traveling, and it started to have difficulties coming in. The weather was very bad, and then Madhvacharya facilitated that boat. Through his mystic powers, he made the whole scene very peaceful and non-threatening, and the boat was saved. And then out of reciprocation, they wanted to offer Madhvacharya something. So they gave him this big ball of chandan, isn't it? And then when that was broken open, they found a beautiful deity inside. Which deity? Yeah. So, this beautiful deity of Krishna. And they... installed that deity, a big ceremony.
I think when Madhvacharya was taking his disciples to Kurukshetra for a pilgrimage, and he took them to a spot and dig a hole in the ground and took out the club of Bhima.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, and then I think he just showed them that was a... And he lifted it, showed his disciple, and he put it back again, just... That's just one of the points to show that.
There you are.
Also, there was another pastime where he was going somewhere. There was a tension between the Muslims and the Hindus.
Mm-hmm.
So Madhvacharya didn't bother about that. He just went and on the boat, and he met the Muslim king on the other side. And this king wanted to give him the kingdom, but he didn't accept the kingdom. So after that, I think he became more favorable towards... After Madhvacharya, maybe he became more favorable towards the culture of Krishna consciousness. Beating someone like that, you change your heart, right?
Yes.
And there was another pastime where he empowered one of his disciples to defeat these warriors who were causing disturbance. There was just one disciple defeated all the warriors. So, yeah.
Very powerful.
Very powerful,
yeah. So it'd be nice to do some more research today, actually. I can see I can do a bit more reading now today on Madhvacharya. Dig up his pastimes. There's so many dimensions to Madhvacharya. His philosophical contribution, as I mentioned, is the main aim for today. And then his other displays of Herculean strength. So these were all factors in his family and his town appreciating his status. When a great person comes, they typically display extraordinary qualities from their physiology, from their mentality, from their abilities also, from their grasp of concepts. So Madhvacharya was a very important person. And literally whole books have been written about him. There's a nice book which has the description of the four acharyas in it, the life and teachings of the four acharyas. So that's a nice book which contains Ramanujacharya, etc. Nimbarka. Any questions? Anything else?
There is a concept of mindala, and there is a concept of the emotional aspect.
Are they one and the same, or is there any difference? And we have a concept of personal aspect. Krishna.
Yes. It depends how technical you want to go.
But not technicality, but the outcome of it.
See, the thing is that the words that are used, Prabhupada uses the word Mayavad in multiple cases. And sometimes he's speaking about Brahmavadis, sometimes he's dealing with complete Mayavadis. Yeah, in the sense that they're both equally rejectable for us. So in that sense, to make such a labored distinction each time isn't so important. So for example, with Lord Chaitanya, with his pastimes, it refers to defeating of Mayavad constantly. But there's different flavors of it within that. So in one sense, Maya means illusion, that which is illusion. And the staunchest Mayavadis, they consider that the Lord is illusion, or we are illusion. The Buddhists have a sort of a completely nihilism kind of a view on it. The typical Mayavadi considers that we and the Lord are the same, and that our forms are of Maya. Whereas specifically in the Gaudiya Sampradaya, the emphasis is that the form of the Lord is always transcendental. That's a very strong defining characteristic. The form of the Lord is not to be considered material. It's not that Krishna appears in this world and he has a material body like ours. So that also would be considered Mayavad in some discussions. That the concept that the Lord has adopted a body, and it's a very powerful body, it's a very, maybe a very beautiful body like Krishna, but it's still a body. So that's rejected, but that's considered Mayavad. And then you've got the deeper Mayavad, where we don't exist, the Lord doesn't exist, these are illusions. And so there's it's a general term used in multiple ways, but I guess the concepts are quite distinct. You could, Brahmavadis, you could look at them, that they're attached to an impersonal understanding. The four Kumaras were initially sort of attached to the impersonal feature of the Lord. When someone focuses on the Lord, and here it was referring to the Paramatma feature, as being one step higher than the Brahman feature. So, Brahmeti, Paramatmeti, Bhagavaniti, Shabdyate. When one is connected to one of those features, they're connected to the Lord, and that's okay. But the progress possible in terms of developing a relationship is different in each type. With the Brahman engagement, one cannot develop prema, not even with supersoul worship, really. So the Bhagavan aspect has to be involved for one to fully advance. But still, they're all connected to the Lord. So like the four Kumaras who are attached to the impersonal form of the Lord, the impersonal understanding of the Lord as tattva, their transformation took place when they smelt some tulsi leaves. So I don't know if you could call them Mayavadis. You couldn't really, in that sense. But in terms of their practice, you could possibly say, you could possibly use that term in some context. So how it's used is difficult. But they certainly didn't consider the Lord illusion. That's typically what the word Maya denotes, some type of illusion. Prabhuji's question is, was the concept of the four Kumaras a bit like the New Age philosophy of worshipping the universe or something? They know there's something out there, but what it is, they don't know. Possibly, not really, because they're far more competent. They're the original sons of Brahma, and the New Ages are making up things. It's contemplation, speculation. See, philosophers contemplate, they speculate, and they might, by accident, kind of touch on something connected to the truth. Because ultimately, anything that can be conceived has some sort of existence somewhere. So they somehow touch the truth, because ultimately we all do. We're all based upon the ultimate truth. But their descriptions of it are speculation. That's the problem. Speculation is the big problem. Okay, Granthraj Srimad Bhagavatam ki, Sri Madhvacharya ki, Sri Ramachandra Bhagavan ki, Hare Krishna.